home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Woo-hoo. Good evening, good evening. It is Rob Watson on Rated LGBT Radio. Garrett Miller is off tonight, as he has been this season. I am going to bring the spirit of Garrett Miller alive here, though, as I've been doing, just because I want to promote this one song off his album, Blonde Jesus, because it is so perfect for, obviously, the time of year it is, especially if you happen to be a dog owner. So tonight, before I do that, we have a wonderful guest. I've already had the pleasure of interviewing her on my other show out in Santa Cruz. And her name is Kristen Collier. She's actually many things, including a compassionate communication specialist. And she has written a book about her family and the unique experience and journey they have been on. She is a woman who, like many women, married a man and had kids and, you know, white picket fence, I don't know about that. She might not have had white picket fences. We'll have to ask her that part. But the whole ideal came together. And then one day her husband decided, mischaracterization. It was revealed that her husband found he was transgender and discovered the truer aspect of himself in becoming a woman. And suddenly Kristen found herself to be a woman in a marriage with another woman, and her life changed. So that is what we're going to be talking about tonight. But first, a little snippet of Garrett Miller, and guess what? It's Christmas time. And then we'll be right back with Kristen Collier. Or maybe not. Here we go. Okay, that did not work at all. too quiet, too whatever. So get Garrett Miller's album, Blonde Jesus, and you can hear the real song at full volume, and it'll sound great. I actually wanted to talk to Kristen anyway, so what the heck. Here we go. Kristen, good evening. How are you doing?
Good evening. Wonderful. How are you, Rob?
I'm great. It's like we have to stop meeting this way.
I know.
Or maybe we need to meet more this way. I don't know.
There you go.
So, Kristen, I had the pleasure of talking to you last weekend, and we covered a lot of the book. We're going to cover a little bit of the ground because we have new listeners who don't know necessarily what we talked about then. Shout out to them. Shame on you. Listen to both shows immediately. But we're going to placate you, and we're going to revisit some of that ground. But I wanted to, before we got into that, I wanted to see from you, what is some of the reaction to your book? And the book is titled Housewife, Home Remaking in a Transgender Marriage. What feedback have you gotten, particularly from other transgender people?
That's a great question. From most transgender people that I've heard from, almost all of them actually have been really complimentary of the book, both because they think it's a wonderful resource for partners of trans people. And also I've heard from more than one person that in reading it, they were able to imagine what it was like for the partner that they had during transition and see it from their eyes, which was a really valuable thing for them and actually provided them an opportunity for some healing.
Well, and that point that you just made is one of the reasons, because since, you know, I booked you on the shows and read the book and we've talked, I've really been highlighting our conversations in the book as this is something that everybody needs to read and absorb. I mean, it's experience of change in relationships. And even though yours is kind of the outside of the envelope of that type of experience, captures so much of the elements that are a little bit more universal. But more importantly, to the transgender experience, you make the really valid point that the transgender journey is often one that is walked not just by the person themselves, but the people who love them.
Absolutely. And in fact, I'm now aware that even though we say it's gender transition from one gender to another, actually the people who are going through that process are quite fixed in their truth. And in fact, in our case, it was me who had to transition in the way I saw my husband so that I could see her as the woman that she really was in her heart. And it was my children who transitioned to see her as their Maddie. They call her Maddie, which is a cross between mother and daddy. And our community who learned to see us in the new family structure that we've come to be.
Right, right. So I'm diving to it. It's hard because we've already talked. And so I'm kind of want to go to the Kristen Robb level in the conversation, but you know, I'm going to be gracious to those who were not there with us necessarily and need to catch up. Can you give us an overview of the story that, you know, what your experience was and that you went through and how it inspired you to write the book?
Absolutely. So 13 years ago, my husband came to me and told me that he wanted to wear women's clothing. And that was a shock to me at the time, even though I thought I was pretty open-minded. And then took about 3 years of therapy for him to realize that he was indeed transgender. And at that point to decide to live the rest of his life as a woman. And then began the arduous process of hormone therapy and laser and beginning to come out slowly, socially, because there's that social transition and then the medical transition, which kind of happens during that. And then it was several years more before there was any surgery involved, but it has taken time. It's been across years. And at about 10 years ago, when he realized that he needed to transition to living full-time as a she, I realized within that year that I was definitely heterosexual. There was a man who came into my life that helped me notice that very clearly. And within the next few years, we opted to, instead of splitting up, we were open. We didn't really think that we had to stay together forever, but we knew we had it really good. We were really enjoying our relationship still so much as parenting partners. And we didn't want to rush into splitting all of our resources because we didn't think it would really support the kids and it wouldn't really support each other. We'd been best friends for, you know, 15 years. And so we decided to build an addition onto the house. And Seda has her own wing now with an office, bedroom, and bathroom. And we both have the space to have our own romantic partners. At this time, I'm the only person who has a romantic partner, a wonderful man who is just fantastic and funny and cooks for us 5 days a week, which is fabulous. So we all join together at the dinner table and to do dishes and connect every evening. It's like a huge standing point in our family that we do that. And we play games together and we play football together and we watch movies together. So we basically right now have a family of five and sometimes six because my romantic partner has a son too, who is going to be visiting us. And that'll be sweet.
That
definitely opened the box.
Right. Yeah. And which is, you know, characteristic of a lot of families. There are very few families that are really as fixed as the media likes to portray them and maybe American, you know, traditional thinking likes to portray them, that, you know, the broader tent of the family is growing and it works and it's wonderful when that happens. I love how this is in our other conversation too. Yeah. You mentioned you're sort of coming out and coming to the realization of your heterosexuality. And I have to tell you, that's like the most refreshing thing. I don't think I've ever had a conversation with anybody who has directly had to address their heterosexuality that way. And it's just unique and wonderful to hear it. So,
well, you know, it was kind of funny because, you know, in looking back, I can see that Seda and I, we only had one fight during the first several years of our marriage, and it was where the Midwest was, where it began, and whether Wyoming was included in the Midwest, which she was adamantly opposed to. And so over the years, everything was so peaceable, and we
yeah.
almost
by,
like
by
had
the way,
the same
I hear
brain.
That is a common fight for almost all couples. We all have
serious?
The fight about where the Midwest started. So don't feel bad. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So yeah, and so yeah, I probably should have figured out if we had like the same brain like that, that maybe we were gendered the same. But it wasn't until all of that came out, and I kind of came out of that phase of denial, which I really was in for the first several years, and I wasn't aware of it. I just thought that I had no idea, you know, that piece of my husband didn't have any place, and we can go into that further if you want to. But at any rate, the point at which I realized that she was a she, I suddenly was aware that, you know, she and I had both come from kind of bumpy childhoods in some ways, and we came together when I was 18 and my husband was 30, and we just supported each other in healing, and we had this incredibly harmonious relationship, and I feel like we grew together for those several years and healed so much stuff. And I wonder if I was really, really ready for a completely heterosexual relationship when I was 18, having watched my mom's two marriages fall apart, you know, or if I really leaned into the comfort and likeness of this other human being, and then later was able to navigate the actual difference in chemistry between male and female, which can shift so much. I mean, I don't mean to have a fixed concept of gender in that, but in general, right. There is a chemistry difference that I have personally experienced. And I'm sure all of us with our various sexual orientations experience on some level.
I totally experienced that because, you know, I came from a different place on it, but, you know, cause I like the aesthetic of women. And when I was in high school, there was a girl that I spent a year mooning over, madly in love with from afar, you know, unrequited love. And after that year, we ended up, you know, in a situation where I had my arms around her and, you know, that physicality was there. And all of a sudden it was like, it wasn't there.
Yeah.
And it was like, what is this? You know, it's like the intellectual and the emotional didn't meet that exactly what you're talking about. So,
right.
You know, I think that's it, you know, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. And it had never been so clear to me as when I met a man that I was actually attracted to. And I'm not attracted to a whole lot of people in that way, in that kind of chemistry, sexual pull way. But wow, I really experienced it. And I thought, wow, I don't think I've ever really had this before, you know, because I got married pretty young. So I didn't have a lot of experience anyway. So it was really interesting.
You bring up an interesting point about, Fred was your original husband's name, and correct. And
it is. We call it the F word now. We don't say it a lot.
The F word. Okay, the F word. Very good. The F word. But you just made a comment that actually got me thinking or posed something in my mind. Do you think potentially that the original attraction, the original love between the two of you was actually for her then presenting at him attracted to who he sort of inwardly saw himself, that you were more of a role model for who he really was than necessarily particularly a spouse?
That's a good question. It's fascinating to me in looking back at what I thought I had caught on the end of my line at age 18. I think I was delighted that I had found a very manly man who had been a fisherman in Alaska, who was a rancher's son. And mind you, I was on my way at the time to New York City to study theater. So the people I'd been hanging out with had their heart on their sleeves and, you know, were just emotionally up and down. And here was this steady guy in a flannel shirt and jeans with a beard. And, you know, he was just, he was hot in that extremely masculine way.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, totally sold me. I'm totally
right.
Like, yeah,
yeah,
right.
You and I'd be mooning together, and so and at the same time, here was this guy who is really sensitive, and smart, and just aware of my feelings and emotions, and just easy to harmoniously step into being with. As soon as he was committed to our relationship, it was like, as soon as he was in full bore, and so was I, and neither of us scared each other off. We were just like one unit. So in looking back, I'm not sure. I think this is the tricky thing about when he transitioned for me, is that I was devastated in a way, because I felt like, was that man that I fell in love with, was that real? You know, I mean, the outer
right.
trappings, you would say, were not real, right? And yet there was a piece of those with the chemistry, which is why I think that our concept of ourselves and our identity is really a co-creative process. It's internal and external. And so even though I think that inside he was very confused about his gender, but hadn't put his finger on what that meant or was, just felt like there was something loathsome and unidentified inside of himself that was a mystery that he couldn't bring forward into the world. And I didn't see that part very much. I just saw that he was depressed sometimes and whatnot. But on the outside, you know, there was this person who was very loving and generous with me, and we built this relationship that was really strong. So it's very confusing when the masculine part began to disintegrate. I was like, what was I in love with? And I'm sure I was in love with that core person of who she was, but that core piece didn't really have a gender, but gender is part of our identity. And so
right.
I couldn't, you know, and so the masculine gender that he wore as a mask was part of the identity that I fell in love with. Yes. And yet, even though he couldn't completely relate to me from that place, there was still some truth in our bond. And that truth is carried forward in more of a family sense, but it's not, she is not the same person he was. It really feels like she is like a sister, especially now that she's fully developed, you know, into
right.
her own persona.
Right. Well, and I have to say, on a superficial level, because obviously not anywhere near close to your personal experience, which is deep and, you know, thorough, but, you know, even the Bruce Jenner, Caitlyn Jenner transition, you know, when Bruce Jenner was a runner and, you know, I was younger than he was, but he, you know, that happened when I was, you know, in high school or whatever. And, you know, it was like, oh my God, he's, you know, incredibly, you know, sexy, attractive and all that. And then, you know, to go through that where Bruce becomes his real self, Caitlyn, you know, I get that, but there was this hot guy that, you know, was there, you know, it's like, you know, and you know, it's not ours to own, it's them, but
right.
it's still there. But that leads me up to a question I wanted to ask you about, you know, because you mentioned to me before that the experience for you was very much like experiencing a death, that, you know, someone you loved had literally gone away and actually kind of died. And I wanted to ask you if that went deeper to actually experiencing like the six levels of death and grieving, and, you know, if you actually experienced those over the F words transition to Seda.
Yeah. I absolutely. In fact, I read, was it Joan Didion's book about grieving the loss of her husband? And it was really amazing to me to read about, you know, as when he died, going back and experiencing that, and experiencing the denial, experiencing all of those different levels of grief. And yet they don't necessarily, it's not hierarchical. They come and go and intersperse and intertwine. And because the dying of my husband took some time, you know, we went round and round with those and sat with the confusion during that time too. It was very ethereal. It was a very strange and ethereal death, in which, you know, as we were talking about with the identity, you go back and you go, wait a second, was that even real? And that's something that you ask yourself in the grieving process, even when somebody dies too. Like, you feel like, huh, that's impossible. Just yesterday they were here and now they're gone. And looking at your husband, who still looks like your husband, but you realize that he doesn't see himself as your husband anymore. He sees himself as a woman. So even what you're looking at is already gone. That is eerie.
Right. Well, and it must be strange for the differences as well, because in one, that, you know, obviously there's a part of the person that isn't actually gone, that even though it's transformed, but also that you are kind of implicit in the process,
yeah,
in a weird sort of way, in that, you know, you're, you know, giving input, where in the physical death, it, you know, I mean, you may give input on life support, but you're not saying, you know, no, I don't think you should go to the kidney failure way. I think you should hold, right, the, you know, not do that. I mean, it's, you know, you actually seemingly voice that. I guess my question, and this is coming from the cisgender position, just as you are, is what do transgender people feel about those of us around who experience their former selves as a death? Is that, is like the Sita, when you talk about that, does she go, oh yes, I totally understand that, and, you know, I understand your grief, or is it more of an affront to her?
No, she's been very understanding about it, but Sita has a very open heart and a lot of compassion for what I went through, and really honors that as a transformation and transition in itself. I can't speak for all trans people, but like I said, the bulk, I think the only negative thing I've had, you know, usually that can come up, that's only come up a couple of times, is around language. It's so hard to choose language. It's impossible to choose language to talk about this stuff with that we're all going to agree is respectful language. Different people's needs for respect are met in different ways.
Right.
So, I mean,
right,
queer is one thing to one person and a different thing to another. So, you know, that's going to be hard. And also, there is the sense also for some people, like, oh, what is she, you know, this isn't really her thing. This is really Seda's thing. So I've heard that from other people, but not from Seda herself. For Seda herself, she has been very clear with me that she supports my process and my journey, just as I have supported her process and her journey. And she can totally understand why it was a death. And she was not only that, but she held my hand as I grieved it. And
right,
really, as I walked her across that threshold, as we walked across that threshold together, into a new life where our roles were redefined and our identities were redefined.
And that sentiment that it's not your thing, it's her thing, and sort of like, gee, aren't you privileged, get over it type, which I'm projecting is probably a little bit of the attitude. How often do you think the spouses and family members of transgender people experience that?
Well, transition, gender transition is such a process physically and emotionally that I think that most people don't get stuck, who are, you know, people going through gender transition, don't get stuck in feeling kind of self-righteous about that for very long. You know, it might be across years. It depends on how many of their other needs are met and how supported they are in general. If they're able to move through that and mature enough to where they see, you know, are able to build that awareness again of people outside of themselves, because it is such a cocoon phase, you know, that metamorphosis. They have to go inside of themselves to find who they are deep inside, and then how to regrow those wings, and so that they have the colors that represent their soul in the way that they intended to. That takes time and that takes energy, but it takes a whole lot of self-focus. So of course it takes them a while to go, oh, you had a story in this? What was that? You know, and one of the things that I love about having gone back and written this book is the way to look at our stories intertwining. I would love to someday do some writing with Seda. We've talked about it, to bring our stories together in some way. I think it would be fun as a theater piece.
Yeah, no, I think that, I think that would be intriguing in a lot of the LGBTQ experience of intertwining the people in our lives experience. My sister is a conservative Christian Republican, you know, Orange County, California, you know, the complete opposite of somebody who, you know, should have a gay brother. And
I was going to say, good thing thinks she has you, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm outspoken, liberal, you know, progressive, not gay under a bushel, you know, the exact opposite. And I don't know that I'm courageous enough to ask it. And cause she writes, she hasn't written anything about this, but I think that dual voice piece would be interesting, showing different perspectives on all of our kind of stories, that, you know, it's because it isn't, and this is going back to your point, is it isn't in a vacuum. It is, you know, it is shared by other people in our lives, that can experience it even more so than the person going through it. But going the other direction on that, what has Seda gone through in your lockstep in somebody on the transgender journey for themselves? What, at what point in her story did you stop and go, I'm so shocked that she's had to deal with this, you know, either blowback on her being transgender or prejudice or whatever. What has shocked you that you didn't realize that was part of what she was going to have to experience?
Well, one piece that I was intensely involved in that is actually in the book is the chapter on shopping for prosthetic breasts for her, because it turns out that a lot of places, including the store where I got the breasts, that the proprietress was only willing to do a return if it was to somebody who is a woman specifically. And she kind of looked at me with one eyebrow raised. And so you have to imagine I'm in there shopping with my two children under the age of 6. And and she asks me if I'm looking for them for myself. And I look down and I'm like, yeah, I can see how she thought that. But no. I was actually, and then I'm thinking in my head, wow, I hadn't thought about why I'm looking for these, you know? And I mean, I hadn't come out to friends. I hadn't come out to community. I hadn't expected to get a salesperson asking me if I needed help. So I'm suddenly making up this story, and I'm not a person who lies either, you know? And so I've got this friend and she's going to have surgery, and yeah, it's for a woman. And she looked at me and she said, well, if it's for a woman, then we do have a policy that it can be returned if it's not quite the right fit or size, but that's only for a woman because some people, you understand, have other purposes. And she kind of looks at me and I'm thinking, yeah, like my husband, right? So that was really scary to me. That was the first kind of awakening that, wow, the rest of the world, I mean, it's minor. It's not like she was out to get him, but it was a clear, like, closed door. You're not really human if you want these for anything other than post-surgery for cancer. You know, transgender people are sick and we don't want that kind in our store. That was the message I got. And I was, you know, I'm this wholesome looking mother with children. And who are feeling up the silky sleepwear at that point. And I'm like, you know, really, this is our family. This is a human being. This is my spouse. And I want to be seen and I want to have that return policy apply to us. That's not fair. But I can't say that. At that point, I didn't say that. I just kind of went off, you know, and bought them and hoped for the best. But it was terrifying to realize that that was the world I was stepping into. Now, that having been said, we've had an easier go of it than most people. Partly, I think, well, okay, I want to even say largely because we have trusted that the world is going to be kind to us. That's, of course, not going to cover all the bases, but it's going to cover a lot of them. So we haven't gone in with any kind of fear or worry that there was anything off or wrong about us. And we've gotten stronger over time that that's the case. I remember actually even like a few years ago when the kids had a play date coming over, not a few years ago, maybe like 5 years ago. And I would talk with the parents because I wasn't sure if they knew what they were getting into with their kids coming over, that we had a really non-traditional family, because I didn't want the embarrassment of my kids going through like some kind of a scene in the front of the house. You know what? They've got, you know, two moms and another romantic partner. So, you know, that kind of stuff was hard, but Seda herself didn't, she encountered some discrimination, you know, here and there. Probably the biggest one was the city had an exclusion on providing health insurance for treatments for transgenderism. And that was a huge thing. And it got turned around just in time for her to be able to afford surgery. But that was a huge thing for a number of people. And she fought it really hard, and so that they could finally step into what we see as their integrity and offer it to everyone.
Right. And you know, with events that are happening in the country that are probably going to get worse now that, you know, the current regime is getting into place, And it's not even Donald Trump. It's actually a lot of the appointee people that he has with him and the people who feel empowered in Congress. What are you in CETA as things are coming up that are restrictive towards transgender rights? Do you get involved, or you feel like you're activists, or are you kind of watching from afar going, you know, oh, that's horrible, but, you know, we've got other things we have to deal with?
No, we're definitely involved. CETA, very, very, very deeply so. She's one of the board of directors for a group called Transponder in Eugene, and they're actually partnering with BRO right now to do outreach and provide education for more people across Oregon about transgender people. So she's been actively involved for quite some time in the trans community. I've been busy writing a book in a dark corner for a long time. And now that I'm finally bringing the book into the light, I feel like I'm in a position to be able to have a voice and have some leverage with that voice, which is very exciting to me. So I've been writing a number of byline articles right now for a variety of publications online primarily. And it's exciting to me to be able to my mind about some things such as being able to connect with people first before having the difficult discussions about a difference of opinions and values around diversity. But I really, really, truly believe after my learning what I've learned with nonviolent communication that when we want to connect with someone and we see that injustice is being done in the world, we need to listen first. So
right.
my activism is more based around we need to listen and create harmonious relationships and find new ways to work together to make this world a safer place in general. And hers is specific to transgenderism. There's a lot of overlap. That's where we are.
Right, right. So I want to go to your dating life. At what point did you decide in the process of your experience that you were going to date outside, that you were going to open it up, you were going to look for your romantic partners elsewhere?
Yeah, I don't know that it was ever any kind of a conscious decision. I mentioned that I met someone who helped me to realize I was heterosexual. That was wow. That really shook me to my core. And interestingly, that man was not available sexually for his own reasons, but we had this relatively chaste, almost like courtly love, and that in the romantic part of it definitely had the chemistry of male-female for me, but it wasn't a full-blown relationship. And I think that the universe provided that for me because I'm not sure that I would have stepped away from my marriage so concretely at that point. I was basically stepping into an intimate friendship, and in the course of that realized that I was really ready to step away from my romantic relationship with CETA, and we severed ties at that point romantically and, you know, split sleeping spaces and everything. And then about a year after that relationship let go on its own way, and then I did actually start to date someone for the first time. And that was pretty scary because I hadn't dated anyone since I was 18 and had dated CETA. So it had been a lot of years. And
I'm just visualizing, I mean, just at that point, I mean, yeah, I can see why it would be scary because, you know, normally in the whole dating pool, it's like if somebody finds out, it's like, oh, she's actually already still involved with somebody, or oh yeah, she's actually married to somebody. Those alone are like, okay, this is going to be a difficult conversation. How the heck did you bridge what was going on in your life with outside romantic prospects?
Well, I think probably the easiest way to address that would be to jump to the partner that I have now, because that was the time that I think I really explicitly went out looking, you know, for someone.
Right.
Because the second relationship I had, it was somebody who I knew who was a music teacher. And so we kind of already had a relationship going. But the whole point of like, okay, I'm now single and now I'm aware that I'm actually single, even though I'm technically legally still married because we've got a great insurance policy with the city. I am single and I'm really wanting to have a romantic partner. So how am I going to do that? So whenever I would respond to an ad, because mind you, I don't really drink, so I don't go out to bars. It's not me. I accidentally picked up someone at a bar once and it was terrible because he just wanted to keep going out drinking and I didn't, you know? So it was, so I ended up responding to ads on Craigslist usually. And it would go great, or on OkCupid, and it would go great until I told them the whole thing, which was usually in the first like couple of emails. I wanted to be really upfront about it, but then I would hear nothing back. So I finally decided, okay, I'm just going to place the ad myself. And it was titled Outside the Box. And it said, you know, look, I'm a soccer mom. I'm a hybrid. I go between my car and my bicycle. And I have, you know, I'm an urban farmer, and then I've got this parenting partner who is my former husband. You know, at that point, a lot of people stopped reading and went to the next one, you know, and I've got two kids. And then there was this like handful of people who responded. I have to say, some people responded and said, wow, that's really amazing. You sound like a really interesting person, and no thanks, but good luck. You know, it was hilarious. And then there was this man who responded, you know, I'm outside the box too. And he was in so many ways. And what was most outside the box with him was just the flexibility and open-mindedness that he brought, the lack of fear that he brought as an artist, as both with paint and with food. He was from San Francisco Bay Area, actually from LA originally, but then he'd been in the Bay Area. So he was very open-minded, and we had a relationship for, I don't know, probably a month or so before I integrated him with the family, and we were at a soccer game, and he was a little bit nervous that he might be jealous or something about Seda. But the interesting thing that all of the men I've been with, which is only three since my marriage, is that they haven't actually felt jealous about Seda, because Seda doesn't have, we don't have this male-female energy. It's not like living with your former partner in the house. It's really right. So different. If they felt any form of jealousy, it was just because we had like this deep friendship that, you know, that they had a hard time competing with the closeness in terms of intimacy that we have, like just as friends, how much we rely on each other on a day-to-day basis in a practical way. But this man that I've been dating has also merged into our family in such a practical way in bringing, you know, food to life for us. But when he first met Seda, he was on the soccer field with us, and he just jumped right into the game. And literally, that's how it's been. He's just been in the game, and we've figured it out along the way, but there has not been missteps around that at all. It's been easy.
Right. For some reason, that doesn't really surprise me that much, because I would think that your new partner would react to the real Seda. I mean, that's all he's known that person to be, where he doesn't have that double vision of what used to be and who that person is now. Dichotomy. So I think it makes a lot of sense. But I want to shift gears a little bit with, so you're a mom, a very good mom, and you know the depths of the soul of raising a child. And now you've had this experience with the challenge of being transgender and the risk to emotional, mental, spiritual health that presents. What perspective has that given you to other situations, like parents who have a child, and I've worked with a couple of them now, that the child, as soon as that child is able to speak, says, I'm not who you think I am. I'm not a girl. I'm not a boy. I'm actually the other. What perspective does that give you from your experience now?
Well, it is worth noting that 6% of our population is transgender, as far as we can tell so far. And that's a higher percentage than most of us are aware of. So it's very real. And we were lucky when Seda transitioned that things went as harmoniously as they did. And of course, neither of us would have been sorry regardless, because we have two amazing kids. But of course, in many ways, looking back, it would have been so much easier if she had known and had the context for it earlier and been able to transition earlier, even though we probably wouldn't have had the relationship that we had. So when we see young people, especially young people who are so certain about their genders, being different than the one they were assumed to be when they were born, I really feel strongly in advocating for them to, you know, get the support that they need to make that shift. In addition to being a writer and an educator, one of my places as an educator is I'm actually a sex educator. So I've been teaching classes based on the Our Whole Lives curriculum, or the OWL curriculum, which is an incredibly inclusive sex positive curriculum. And it includes lessons around gender identity and as well as sexual orientation. And a number of the videos that we show the kids and discussions that we show, you know, preteens and teens are about these young people who have transitioned. And it is just so poignant to watch their parents reflect over the same kind of transition that I experienced of thinking that you had one person in your family and realizing that you had another, and realizing that in the scope of all of the things that can go wrong in your life, this is really not that big of a thing. I mean, when you really step back and take a look,
right,
you still have a happy, healthy, strong human being in your family that you can love. And it's just that they're a different gender. So, you know, we do what we can to support them, because the alternative is that it's like a 60% higher chance of suicide without that.
Yeah, no, it's horrible. And suicide and all sorts of, you know, depression,
you know, and
really emotional
anxiety. Yes.
I have quite a few close friends who are transgender, and, you know, I don't think they don't unload on me on their own experiences that much. I mean, I get, you know, a story here or a story there, but I also see it, you know, it's one of those things when you're not a part of a population that is at being put at a disadvantage or criticized or looked down upon. You know, a lot of times you see it third hand, see them being treated in a way or looked at in a way, or, you know, just, you know, something very subtle, but still there. And then trying to extrapolate what that must feel like to see those looks, those glances, whatever, every single day, and what kind of toll that takes. I mean, have you experienced that kind of thing with Seda?
Not a lot, because one thing that I'm a firm believer in as a communicator in general is that if you just sit around looking at each other, then things can get extremely awkward extremely quickly, regardless, but especially, you know, if people have questions about transgenderism, because we're so out in our way of going and we're so open to people asking questions, that really relieves a lot of tension right there. And we're usually like, let's be busy doing something. You know, we're here because we're working on this project. And as soon as people see that we're in the same work together, then they see her as a person, and it's not an issue anymore. So we never stop and really like make it an issue. We don't allow it to be an issue. We're just like, we're going on and seeing them in their wholeness and beauty, and we get that reflected back. Because whenever you look at someone and see how amazing they are, they don't look at you and think, oh, wait a second, I'm not sure that person's right. They're just happy to be seen, right? And then they go on, and that connection is there, and then you are empowered together to make change happen.
Wonderful, wonderful. You've alluded to it a little bit in our conversation tonight, but we talked about it the other night as well. Can you go through the arc with the kids? You know, what were your concerns about them before, you know, as the whole process was happening? Because I know in my family, when, you know, some devastating changes were underway long before the boys even knew about them, you know, my head was there first.
Right.
And then, you know, through the process, all the way through to, you know, mom seeing other people, and what does that mean, and how does that play out? What was the arc for your family in that perspective, in that way?
I think it definitely affected them, even though it was subconscious, when Seda and I were wrestling with the reality of her being transgender and trying to understand what to do with it. So there was a lot of grief that we were experiencing, a lot of confusion, and I'm sure that that shaped them on a cellular level when they were tiny, even though they didn't understand it. But what happened in the course of Theta and I working with that is that we ended up being able to give each other empathy on it, come to understand each other, grow compassion for each other, so that when we actually told them when they were 4 and 6 that this was the case, Theta said that she had never felt comfortable in her body and told them that she was going to be living the rest of her life as a woman, and that had nothing to do with them or her care for them. That wouldn't change. And she asked if they had concerns, and the only concerns that they had came from the older one. The younger one was like, oh, okay. The older one said, well, worried that I'm not going to be able to recognize you tomorrow morning. And she said, oh my goodness, that's not going to happen overnight. Don't worry. I mean, I'm sure she would have loved it if it did, but it wasn't going to happen overnight. It was going to take months or years even. And he also wondered if she would play rough with him still. And she assured him that she would. And so they changed pronouns right away. Actually, they reminded me to change pronouns as needed. And they began to call her their Maddie, which is cross between mother and daddy.
Right.
And then after that, we went on. And I think it was within that year that I had that intimate friendship with a man who is called Jack in the book, and he was coming over a lot. And so right away from a really we become conscious and have a memory that we're collecting in any kind of a conscious way right around 5 or 6. So during most of their conscious and memorable lives, there's been like another person who's been kind of in and out of their world. So Jack showed up, he was supportive. He was like a friend, a really close friend. And then after a while, when he and I split again, the grieving that I experienced, which probably wasn't just due to Jack, and I included that in the book because I suspect that that's something that other people experience too. It reminded me so much of the severing process of my marriage, I think on a deeper level. And just the very fact that I was actually truly single now, and I was even more single than I was before when I first met Jack, and I wasn't completely out of my marriage yet. And so to then go on and meet, and I was my music teacher, and I began to see each other, and the kids just seemed kind of open to it, because I think they were aware that Theta and I weren't romantically together. We hadn't been for some time.
Right.
It didn't seem that odd that I would have, a boyfriend. They weren't really clear on what all the roles are in different relationships. This is Eugene, after all. A lot of kids have multiple parents. They don't all live in the same household. So they just kind of emerged, and they didn't have a lot of questions or concerns about it. And now, they talk to, they say that when somebody asks them about it, like at school, they don't tend to talk about like their Maddie as their Maddie, because then they said it becomes the topic of conversation when they were actually having a different topic of conversation. They don't want to explain, this peripheral piece that, there's this whole other history around this human being. So they want to get the topic done. So they might call her their other mom, or they might call her their other parents. And then if they're closer, then they'll say Maddie. And if they have a friend who doesn't really understand what that would be like or look like, usually they said the friend doesn't say much, but then if they come over to our house and they see, oh, say it's just a regular person, it's not a big deal. And, we all just, we're very upfront with everything. And we joke around a lot. And so they're immediately comfortable, and it's not been an issue for the kids.
When you were talking, I got a couple of, these are probably a little more off the wall questions. Not that I haven't hit you with those already, but what the heck. So would you say that the kids though sort of were looking through a heteronormative pair of glasses with your relationship, in that, okay, who is formerly dad is now Maddie and a woman, therefore that means, this is no longer a romantic relationship, without considering that there could have been a lesbian relationship with her?
No, I don't think so. I think that, in fact, what's interesting in that is that Theta did have a lesbian relationship, in the course of that, and they didn't bat an eye over that either. So I think that their main concern is whether their emotional and physical needs are met by their parents. And beyond that, they're really okay with their parents having whatever relationships they have because it didn't impact them. The only thing that impacted them from my relationships was the grief when I would let go. And I do think that that grief was exponentially greater because I was still grieving in some layers my marriage, which had been a really solid marriage.
So one question I have, and this is, again, a little bit more off the wall and bringing my perspective. One thing in the book you write about, and you talk about Fred as the F word, the former person, and as a father, and, you know, you were describing, you know, what was there. Now I'm bringing to, you know, as the reader or this particular reader as a gay dad reading it. And what you described of him as a father is different than the father I am. You know, you described somebody who, and, you know, correct me if I'm wrong or I misread it, but, you know, somebody who had full intention of being full parent and all that, but kind of a sort of like going, okay, tell me what you do. Cause I know this is a, like, new thing, you know, I'm sort of out of my element here. This is, you know, I'll help, but, you know, it's like, I'm the dad. I'm, you know, not the primary caretaker, sort of falling into that role. Now for me as a gay dad, I bopped right into full role. I wasn't asking anybody. It was, you know, instinctual, and I was right there. So one, is that the reality? But two, since Seda has become Seda, have you detected more of a parental instinct that is part of the emerging personality that wasn't necessarily there before?
I'm really glad you asked that question because you mentioned that during our last interview that there was that distinct difference that you experienced as a father figure than what you saw that Seda had experienced when she was my former husband. I think that a piece of what my husband struggled with was around gender stereotypes because he had been raised by people who, you know, grew up in the 40s, 50s. And he came from a ranching home and, you know, the father tried to be the head of the family. And there was just kind of like this real masculine stereotypes around the father. So he had taken on those masculine stereotypes and was literally wearing them like an uncomfortable overcoat. And it was so stuffy inside of that overcoat that he couldn't even find the person that he was and wanted to be and how to connect as the human being that she really was. And so after transition, when she was able to take the overcoat off and go, oh, thank goodness, this is who I really am, and access her emotions and become vulnerable, truthful to herself, live in her integrity with the world, then she found that she could step into integrity in relationship with her kids. And then her awareness expanded tremendously as well. And so she was able to connect with the kids and see what they needed and when they needed it and move to that much faster. And on top of that, then she started to work towards picking up the gender, the stereotypical female side of, okay, I'm going to multitask and I'm going to, you know, keep an eye out for what, you know, the children need and stuff like that. So she was working on taking that on. It's very interesting. At the same time that her heart was really open and she was able to, and I think that honestly, the hormones did help. The estrogen did help her mind to kind of open up to multiple tasks at the same time too. She used to play chess as a man and she doesn't play chess nearly as much and as avidly.
Interesting. Well, it again, this is part of, goes to one of those core points that I think is a universality of your story and why I think people who are not even in that experience would get a lot out of it in terms of just the difference of not, you know, these are the things that are naturally coming out of you as a presenting male or as a presenting female, but these are the things that we pick up because we now have the freedom to walk away from a gender stereotype. Yeah. And if we could just, you know, how much richer our lives would be if even comfortable in the gender we're presenting as, that we could walk away from the stereotype, you know, anyway.
Yeah, it's so true. And that's one of the reasons why I titled the book Housewife, because I actually really embraced and continue to embrace domesticity, and creating a home is just a joy for me. But at the same time, I don't want it to be expected. I don't want to be saddled with that. I want it to be something that I choose. And so to wrestle with that desire in me to create a home, but to not have that assumption that I was going to do that by my family and by the world around me, I wanted people who are in the role of domesticity, whether it's a housewife or a house husband, to be recognized for the beauty that they individually bring to the work. And so that it's not just a role, even though it's one of the most common roles out there, it's like mother or father, that we look at that more carefully and don't make assumptions about what it's going to be. And so that they can still, whoever's playing that role, it is just a role. And there are many other roles that they are able to play, and so that they can fully manifest who they are in the world. And
right,
it's not a
right.
lot.
So I have a little bit of shocking news for you. We only have 4 minutes left, believe it or not.
It's gone so fast. I love your questions, Rob. You have great questions.
Thank you. I love your answer. So there's kismet there. So pulling out another, hopefully a great question, you know, what would you say to someone? What was your counsel from your learned vantage point now of people who are today, you know, finding out the very first snippets, news, in being informed that the person they're with is actually someone else and they are going to have to walk this path? What direction would you give a newbie today?
You know, I'm going to open that up. I'm going to follow your model and open that up beyond just people who are experiencing one partner being transgender. I'm going to open that up to those experiencing a partner having an affair, or, you know, some other big life transition in their relationship that kind of shakes the relationship to the core. I think it's really important to give space to the difficult emotions of anger. And then as we take apart anger, the grief, the fear underneath it, and to just sit with those difficult emotions for some time and know that they're going to pass. And confusion, especially, so hard to sit with, but it will pass. And to not make decisions in a place of confusion, which is almost always present in those early days of a transition within a relationship. And to realize that transition in relationship can be a restructuring and a change in which the roles might remain the same, but you're never actually going to be the same people in them. Or the roles might shift, but I really think it's important to go through the process of getting empathy for yourself and even giving yourself empathy, and so that then you become more emotionally available to give the other person empathy and connect. Because from that place of connection, that's where the restructuring is going to happen slowly. So have acceptance for the difficult times. It's okay. It's okay for that. It's going to be hard. You know, but then come together and work it through
perfect.
Together.
I love the answer, and I love that vision. And we are almost out of time. So where can we find Housewife Homemaking in a Transgender Marriage? Where can they get the book?
You can actually get that book at any independent bookstore, but you can also get it at the big bookstores. You can get it online on my website. If you do it online on my website, I'll even send you a signed copy at kristenkcollier.com. And you can also get it on Amazon. Thanks, Rob.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining me yet again. And we'll have to figure out another way to come together and talk some more on other subjects and everything else. But this
fantastic.
Book is fantastic. Everybody needs to read it. Also, if anybody's looking for some great music, go to GarrettMiller.com and get his album Blonde Jesus, especially the Christmas song that I completely bungled and didn't play well on this broadcast, but you need to go get it anyway. It's guess what? It's Christmas time, and it is purely poignant if you happen to be a dog owner. It's all about dog owners at Christmas time. So that's wonderful. And you've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. I'm Rob Watson. Listen again next week. Also catch Out in Santa Cruz, outinsantacruz.com or casio.com. And Saturday at 7 p.m. And we'll have a great show there. Wendy Michaels joins me this weekend there. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.